Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the Renaissance English History Podcast, a member of the Agora Podcast Network. I'm your host, Heather Tesco, and I'm a storyteller who makes history accessible because I believe it's a pathway to understanding who we are, our place in the universe, and our own humanity. This is episode 79, and today I'm talking with Roland Hoy, an art historian who has a new book out on England's queens. It's called The Turbulent Crown. We do talk a bit about portraiture here, so check out the show notes at englandcast.com to see pictures and get the visuals of these paintings. Again, that's englandcast.com. Also, I'm putting the transcript there for shows from now on, so if you want to go back and read something or check something out, you can do that at the website as well. Okay, let me introduce Roland to you. Roland Hoy received his degree in art history from Concordia University in Canada. After completing his studies, he went on to work in interpretive media for California State Parks, the U.S. Forest Service, and the National Park Service. Roland has written for Renaissance Magazine and for Tudor Life Magazine, and he blogs about 16th century English art and personalities at Tudor Faces, which is tudorfaces.blogspot.com.
Well, my interest has always been in Tudor portraiture, especially the Six Wives and Anne Boleyn. I mean, she's a little problematic because we don't have good paintings of her. The paintings that we have of her, you know, the famous one with the bee necklace, they're actually from the Elizabethan period and the early Jacobean period, like James I. So people say, well, you know, it doesn't really look like her. It can't be her because it was painted long after she died. But my argument is that they were mass-produced during Queen Elizabeth's time, so therefore there was some kind of stamp of approval about that painting, that likeness, okay? And there were people at her court who were, you know, the more senior members who served her father way back then would have remembered what Anne Boleyn looked like. So therefore, I think it's a legitimate image, even though there are different contenders, like there's two Holbein sketches, which one of them, she actually has blonde hair, so I don't think that's her at all. You might, I don't know if, I think your viewers might know it. You're not sure, your listeners will know.
Yeah, I'll add it in the show notes as well.
Yeah, and it's another one, but, you know, who knows? But my bet it's the famous one that works. I think that's her. The Black Book garter image, I came across that in a footnote because I was researching the Six Wives like I always do. And it was buried in a footnote in this journal from 1866, you know, like ancient times. Just one mention saying that, oh, this lady of the garter has an AB pendant, so, oh, it's Anne Boleyn. But, you know, nobody ever thought about it because it's buried in a footnote in this kind of obscure academic journal and from 1866. So I thought, oh, wow, that's interesting. And I tried to look up the image, and all I found was, first of all, was this black and white one, which I thought, oh, that's kind of hard to tell. Then eventually, the people at Windsor Castle, the St. George's Chapel, did put the image online in color. And I thought, oh, wow, yeah, that's an AR there. So my argument is that, well, you know, it was the Black Book was made in 1534 when she was queen because she was crowned in 1533, so 34 works. And there is also a image of Henry VIII as Henry V. So you have a situation where the modern monarchs are playing older counterparts. So if Henry VIII could be Henry V, the image of the lady is supposed to be Queen Philippa, who was Edward III's wife from the late 1300s or whatever. Well, you know.
And that would be Philippa of Hainault. I just want to put that in for people.
Yeah, that's her, yeah. So my thinking was that Lucas Horenbout, the artist, you know, used her as the model for Queen Philippa. She has the AB there. Mm-hmm. You know, it's Queen Philippa, but it's also Queen Anne Boleyn because of the AB.
Yeah.
And they're dressed in modern clothes. It's like a modern court, even though they're supposed to be in medieval times.
Mm-hmm. That's
yeah,
really
so I think that's an interesting find. So it's out there. So I think people, from what I read, seem to think, yeah, it probably is her, and it's most likely it is Anne Boleyn as Queen Philippa.
Yeah, interesting. So your background is in art history and the portraiture of this time. Can you tell me, and this is, I wrote this in my email to you too, when I think about art from the visual arts from 16th century England, I always think about portraits and not these kind of landscapes that you see in Italy and other, well, is that true to start with? And if so, why?
I think for the Tudors, yes, because it was just not that concern for landscaping. It just wasn't their thing. And I think he also had artists at the court who were experts in portraiture, like Holbein. I mean, he did design some jewelry and architectural elements and stuff like that. But his thing was portraiture. I don't think he did landscapes. If he did, there were very few. So he had artists whose specialty was portraiture. And the Tudors were, you know, starting with Henry VII. I mean, you know, he's this new king with this new dynasty on the throne. And he defeated Richard III. So he needed to establish himself and his family. So that was through paintings, through likenesses of his family. There's a painting of him and his family at prayer. So therefore, again, the concern with presenting my new dynasty through, here's what we look like, here's who we are. So Henry VIII took that, and then, you know, he had these miniatures done in the 1520s of himself and his first wife, at least, and a few members of his court. His daughter was one of them. And then when Holbein came on the scene, I mean, you know, he's this excellent artist. I mean, of course, Henry VIII exploited Holbein's talents to the extreme.
So can you give me kind of the broad overview of painting and I guess the visual arts, which would be the painting and the portraits and whatnot during this time period? And then the thing I always think that's interesting about Tudor England is right smack dab in the middle, you've got the change with Edward to being really Protestant and then back to Mary with being really Catholic. And those years of turbulence, I know at least in music, made a really big difference with the liturgical services and how that was done. Can you walk me through kind of what art was like at the beginning of the 16th century and then how that changed by the end and what, if anything, the Reformation, how that affected it? And I know that's like a huge topic. We could do like multiple shows on that.
Art could be decorative. It could be for religious reasons, you know, painting saints and just to glorify God and whatever. I think the big interesting change was art as propaganda starting with Henry VIII and a little bit with Henry VII too, you know, with his painting of his family at prayer. So that's like, you know, we're the new dynasty again. But it was really Henry VIII who I think realized the potential of art as propaganda. So for instance, you have the famous Whitehall mural, which shows him on one side, his wife Jane Seymour on the other side, and his parents above him. So that's the idea of, you know, and the painting was like life-size. So it was, again, somebody said it was, you know, people who saw it were abashed and annihilated by this amazing giant painting. So that certainly had an effect of glorifying himself and his dynasty because his parents were behind him. Like, you know, they started this dynasty. I'm the continuation of it. And my wife was on the other side. She will be the mother, or she is a mother. So yet, I don't know. We know it's painted around 1537. So she might have given birth already, but regardless, the idea is that my dynasty will continue through her. And you had a lot of anti-papal paintings and artwork under Henry VIII. You have pictures of the apostles stoning the Pope, and that was known to be in Henry VIII's collection. And there's another painting with Henry VIII on his deathbed, and then he's pointing towards his son who's sitting on the throne and, you know, saying he's going to be the next king. So my dynasty is continuing on. Don't worry about it. And in the background, you see these king's men pulling down a religious, you know, Catholic-themed statue. So that was probably done during Edward's time, because during King Edward's time, there was this big iconoclasm. You know, destruction of religious images. They're idolatrous. They're superstitious. They're horrible. We don't need them. They don't glorify God. You know, we have churches that are, we strip them of everything. All that beautiful stuff under, which his father actually still retained. I mean, Henry VIII is very Catholic, even though he didn't like the Pope. You know, he kept all his Catholic elements. He did get rid of some of the more superstitious stuff, like, oh, you know, the vial that held the blood of, you know, Jesus, and he got rid of that because, you know, that's fake. But a lot of the images he retained, but under King Edward, I mean, that stuff is gone.
Do we have any kind of record of what was lost during the time? I can imagine that some stained glass windows, perhaps.
Oh, yeah, certainly stained glass windows.
And some altar pieces and things like that.
Altar pieces, yeah. I would recommend to your listeners a book I have it in my hand right now. It's called The Elizabethan Image. It's by Roy Strong, who was the director of the National Portrait Gallery from the 60s to the 80s, I believe. And there's a section he's entitled Art and Anti-Art, and he has these wonderful images of statues with their heads chopped off. And that was deliberate. I mean, people went around during the time of King Edward chopping off heads off statues. And also defacing religious images, that you would have a panel of Saint so-and-so, but their faces would be scratched out. But luckily, I mean, some of the stuff has been kept. I mean, who knows, maybe the monks, the king's men are gone, let's hide this stuff, we'll hope for better days. So some stuff has survived, and these are evidence of the iconoclasm that had occurred during the time of King Edward, which actually continued later on again when Queen Elizabeth, his sister, became queen. She actually had to make a proclamation saying, you stop that. I mean, we need to protect this stuff. I mean, okay, we're a Protestant country, but, this is getting out of hand.
Right, because she was very similar kind of to her father in terms of liking some of the kind of the liturgy or the kind of...
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, she was Protestant, but she had some, she liked some of the older stuff. She actually had a crucifix in her chapel, which shocked people, especially her puritanical members of her court and her counselors. This is horrible. I mean, this is idolatry, but, she's queen, you can't do anything about it. Yeah, so she just keeps some of the older elements in her chapel, and, who knows? I mean, who knows what her inclination was? Was it to please the people and kind of like take a middle way, saying, I'm not this, I'm not this, I'm here to please, or was it, that's her, I really don't like this, and I like this.
Yeah, well, she kept the whole music side of things going with the, some of the greatest. Well, I guess that's then we get into the Elizabethan glory age of music and art as well.
Yeah, and she was smart. She maybe and her counselors in conjunction were smart about using art as propaganda. So you had these images in the later part of her reign where she's in her 60s or in her 50s. She looks like she's 25 again when she came on the throne. This lovely young woman, and as opposed to what she actually looked like, and that was to say that, the queen is young, she doesn't age, she's like England, she will last forever, she will prosper. She's not a woman who's pushing 69 and will be dead in 1603.
Right.
Yeah.
Tell me how she controlled that. Like what were some of the ways that she controlled the way her image was used?
Well, you had somebody called a sergeant painter, which is like the official painter to the monarch. So that was a person who was allowed to take her likeness. Then he would do a facial likeness of the monarch. And then these would be replicated, dozens and dozens of times, sometimes with different costumes, different jewelry. But it's the same, what you call a face mask. It's the same face, but with different outfits and different maybe backgrounds and accessories. So that's how it's controlled. You had an official painter who was allowed, this one man who was allowed to take her likeness and replicate it. Because there were a lot of so-called illegal paintings of the queen circulating in the earlier part of her reign, in the middle part of her reign, which she didn't like. The government actually had to ban them and said, you have to destroy these. They're an offense to the queen. I mean, we don't know what these look like. I mean, what does offensive mean? But it was so much of a big deal that the government had to ban them and destroy them.
And I'm remembering, I feel like there's one very famous portrait of her towards the end. I think it's a black and white, it's like a wood cutting or something. I have it, mm-hmm. I can see it in my head right now, but she looks very old. And it's very rare that you see her like that.
So that image was done by an artist called Isaac Oliver. And he was part of the newer trend of artists who were interested in taking likenesses that were more realistic, as opposed to someone like Nicholas Hilliard, who did all the wonderful, beautiful miniatures of her where she's, eternally young. I'm the goddess Cynthia. I'm the goddess Diana. I don't age. I'm forever beautiful. But he was more realistic. So there are these images that survive of her looking what she looked like when she was in her late 60s. She probably didn't like them, and he probably was not in great favor. And the ones that did survive were the ones that sort of snuck under the radar, so to speak, and survived.
Tell me how these images, both for Henry and for Elizabeth, how would they have been used? Why were they painted? I presume like early on, maybe for marriage negotiations, but tell me about how, when you have a portrait, like the Armada portrait or something, or the Whitehall portrait, mm-hmm. like what were they seen to be doing, and what was their purpose?
Well, to glorify themselves and to glorify an event. So you have the picture of Queen Elizabeth, the Armada portrait, where she's sitting in this wonderful ribbon outfit with this, you know, this big giant hoop skirt. And behind her, it's like a little comic strip in the back where you have a story. It's almost sequential about how the Armada was defeated. So it told a story on one hand. Like, you have to not only look at the painting, but read the painting. So you go from, oh, that's what happened. And, you know, the woman who is responsible is the woman sitting in the center.
And where would these so be hung? Where would it be hung? Like, would it be hung where ambassadors could see it, or?
Probably, you know, most likely it'll be hung in a palace where there was some access to it. It might have been hung in her private chamber. I think they were meant to be seen. But that's something that's very public, I think, that you don't want to just put in your own bedroom and where I'm the only one who gets this. Remember the Great Armada defeat in the 1580s. You do want people to see that. But we don't know, because we don't have records saying where this was hung, where this was placed. For instance, the famous Whitehall mirror, there is controversy about where it was placed in the palace. Was it in the king's private chambers, which very few people had access to, or was it in a more public place, let's say, right above his presence chamber where he greeted the ambassadors and his court? We don't know that. So it would be interesting if it was placed in his private chamber where, you know, people were not really meant to see it, but only himself. So maybe the Tudors also had a concern about art being private too.
Mm.
Yeah.
And what about like a step below the king and Elizabeth? I'm remembering something. I saw a picture of Bess of Hardwick and Hardwick Hall, and how there was one hallway that was all these different kind of portraits of that she would collect. And I'm wondering, like, what maybe I think that's what I remember. But tell me about what are nobles doing with portraits at this point?
Well, in Queen Elizabeth's time especially, they had these what you call long galleries. So they were just a long gallery, and on the sides you would hang paintings of the kings and queens. So you had sets going back from, let's say, it could go as far back as William I going up to the present monarch, Queen Elizabeth. So on one hand, it shows you off as a person of art, of taste. I'm a connoisseur. I love art. I could afford art. I'm wealthy. I have taste. And also it demonstrates the family's ongoing loyalty to the royal family. You know, William I, you know, oh yeah, my ancestors served under him. And then now I serve under the present monarch, Queen Elizabeth. So it's a great way to show off your loyalty, especially when the queen visited you. Oh, there's my portrait. Thank you.
Right. Yeah. Sure. Mm-hmm. Sure.
So they were manufactured sets back then, like the kings and queens. They're like baseball cards.
I was going to say, like trading cards. How funny.
Trading cards, except they're on the wall.
Wow. And so were there artists who specialize, who would like, would they mass produce them at all? Or like,
they they were mass produced prints in the early time of King James and in time of Queen Elizabeth. You had these prints of monarchs. They were like little pinups. I mean, they had a market for them where you would go to they actually would say where you could buy them at the bottom, like, you know, the cross by St. Paul's or whatever at the very bottom, and it was drawn by so-and-so and then engraved by so-and-so, and it's like, here's Anne Boleyn, and people would buy them and collect them, believe it or not. So there was a market for ordinary folks to buy, I guess the modern equivalent would be pinups of kings and queens. Yeah, it's like, you know, we can't afford these panel paintings because they were expensive back then, okay, to have someone, you know, commission a painting. So they were, interestingly enough, collectors of prints even back then.
Wow. And how big were these prints?
They were small. They're like under 8 by 10.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
And how much would something like that cost for the average, like a week's salary, a day's salary, like if you were...
I wouldn't know, but because they were mass-produced, I mean, if you want people to buy them, you price them reasonably.
Yeah.
That's my thinking.
Yeah.
I don't, because they're mass-produced, it can't be that expensive. They're printed, you know?
How interesting.
Yeah.
I had no idea. Wow. That's amazing. Of course, you talked about Henry the Eighth being, and a little bit Henry the Seventh being a kind of... starting this kind of patronage of the arts and having his portraits done and the propaganda, and then the same with Elizabeth on the other side. What about in the middle there? What was going on with Mary and with Edward in terms of art?
Yeah, about those two, there's a wonderful quote by, and let me find that, Horace Walpole, who was a connoisseur of the arts, and he collected art, and he wrote books. And he said, this wonderful quote, "Under a minor prince and amidst a struggle of religions, we are not likely to meet with much account of the arts." And historians call the reign of Edward and Mary and Queen Jane, if you want to put her in there too, as the mid-Tudor crisis, this struggle of religion where neither Edward nor Mary lasted on the throne for very long, so therefore religion was not settled. There was a constant fighting over who's right, who's wrong. Is it Protestant England or Catholic England? So when you have those situations where you don't have peace in the country, things are unstable, it's not a great time to be commissioning art. And plus, you have to have the money for it. And we know that after Henry VIII died, the coinage of England was not in great financial shape. He spent all the money that he derived from the dissolution of the monasteries. You know, he just stripped the monasteries of their gold, their treasures, their plate, you know, and the land that he took from them, and which there wasn't much left, believe it or not, when he died.
Well, he tried to use it on building boats and war with France, huh?
Exactly. He had this very, you know, kind of useless war with France in the last years of his life, and people say that was because he felt betrayed by Catherine Howard, his fifth wife, who was accused of adultery. And it was this big thing to, I need to prove my manhood again, and I need to go to war and be this great warrior king rather than this big, you know, this cuckolded man. So who knows? And so by the time he died, the coinage was debased. You had coins which were not worth the value of the face value. And this problem was not solved until the ending time of Queen Mary. She tried to reform it, but I don't think she went very far. And it wasn't until the time of Queen Elizabeth that she finally rectified the coinage. You know, a pence will be finally worth a pence. It will have the content of silver that it will have. So she took in all the bad coins and then produce better new coins. And believe it or not, she actually made money out of it. I don't know how that worked, but she did. So therefore, if you have the government which was cash strapped, they're not going to go pay for the arts. And also, which was something that was very interesting about Queen Mary, was that because she wanted to change the kingdom from Protestant England back to Catholic England, she wasn't very successful, or she had no inclination of using art as propaganda, which I found, and other historians have found, interesting. You know, why not use art and say, yes, use my paintings to say, yes, we are back to Catholicism. Isn't that wonderful? And it's the proper thing. But her paintings just don't say that. You have these pictures of her portraits. They're just her sitting sometimes, holding a rose, looking at the viewer, looking very plain. I mean, you wouldn't even think she's a queen. There's no kingly / queenly attributes in a painting saying that this woman is the ruler of England who has restored Catholicism in the land. No, it's just very plain and kind of reflecting of her personality. She was a very honest, direct woman. She didn't care for glamour, so therefore her paintings, you know, showed, this is who I am, take me for what I am, that's it. So I think that was a loss, a shame for her, that she did not use the potential of art to glorify herself, to glorify the return of Catholicism, that she's continuing her dynasty. She didn't do that. But Queen Elizabeth did in the middle and later part of her reign with these paintings. You know, I'm the rainbow goddess. I'm standing on the map of England, all these sort of things. And Edward as well, it was not an exploitation of the arts. I mean, there are paintings of him. The most he tried to do in terms of promoting himself, we have these full-length paintings of him standing like his father facing the viewer, like, I am the continuation of Henry VIII. I'm this puny 10-year-old, 12-year-old, but I am king, you know, with his hands on his hips and, you know, the big cod piece in the center as well. Yeah, so in terms of artist propaganda, under Edward and Mary was not successful and not something that was exploited.
And you mentioned how the portraits were more popular and there wasn't really a landscape sort of scene under Henry, and that maybe by the end of the Elizabethan period that was starting to change a little bit.
You see them in the background, but there are not many. There are not many. You have the painting, let's say, Queen Elizabeth confronting the three goddesses. There's a painting of that where she's overwhelming Venus, Hera, Juno, that is, and Minerva, Athena. She's more beautiful than them. And there is a background in the back. But it's not the focus of our attention.
It's such a lost opportunity. I wish there were more, paintings of London at that time period or whatever to really get a sense of.
There are maps. There are maps and there are panoramic views. But I believe these were done by foreigners who came to England. I mean, England did not create, in the time of the Tudors, great artists. There were few. There was Nicholas Hilliard and some obscure ones. John Betts, I think, was English, and these names that we hear the names, but we don't really know what they did. And it was Isaac Oliver, but I think he was from France. His family were French Huguenots, I believe. So there were not a lot of great native artists. They were all imported because England is an island country, and because after when Henry VIII cut himself and his kingdom from the rest of Europe because of the Reformation, that the break with Rome, you cut off the influence of the countries who are more, let's say, advanced in the arts. You sort of isolate yourself.
Can you tell me, well, I don't know if this is your expertise or not, but can you tell me a little bit about the architecture in terms of Henry building his palaces and kind of what you can share about that?
Oh, yeah, he was a big builder of the family. His children did not build. There was just not the money and there's not the inclination because they inherited all these palaces and buildings and homes from their father. There was no need to, first of all, and also I don't think there was the money to build. Henry VIII, we know, did build this wonderful big new palace for himself called Nonsuch in Surrey, which actually I believe was not completed when he died. And there are drawings of it and images of it in later years after the Tudors. And it was a magnificent building.
Wasn't it given to like a king's mistress or something like that in the end?
Yeah, yeah. I think Charles II's mistress, Mrs. Castlemaine, I think it was her or somebody. He gave it to her and she was cash strapped, I believe, because of gambling. So she just tore it down and sold, here's a terrace, take that. Here's a potted plant, take that. And here's a cornice. Here's part of the wall. She was selling parts off, and eventually it just fell into decay, and it's like nothing left. I believe when you actually go there, it's probably just a field, from my understanding of it. There was just nothing left.
What a shame.
It's a shame, yeah, yeah. So other than building Nonsuch, Henry VIII did expand and refurbish the palaces that he inherited from his father, like Greenwich Palace along the river. And also he refurbished York Place, which he seized or was given by Cardinal Wolsey. So that became Whitehall, which was his big, the big show place. And it was Hampton Court, of course. So these were inherited buildings that he expanded on and that he added on to.
And what did he do? This is just a separate question because you just made me think about it, how Hampton Court is. That's very close to Richmond Palace, which his father had built. What did Richmond Palace fall out of use?
I believe so. I think it's the same story as Nonsuch. I don't remember the story offhand, but either it was destroyed by a fire, who knows, or it just fell into disuse. I mean, which happens. For example, you had the royal apartments in the Tower of London, which are next to the White Tower in the center of the whole fortress. Those are gone. That was the royal palace area. We know that Anne Boleyn stayed there for her coronation. They were actually refurbished, and they spent a lot of money to redecorate that set of buildings for her. But by the 1600s, the later part, I believe it was, they were all gone. And now when you go to the Tower of London, it's grass. You would never know that there was this stretch of buildings from the White Tower down to what's called the Lanthorn Tower, which is actually a reconstruction as well in the time of Queen Victoria, that there was this wonderful stretch of buildings that housed the royal family. And they did not refurbish it. It fell into disuse because whoever was king by the time of the Stuarts, they just did not have the inclination to stay there. So they fell into disuse, into disrepair. So they found better use for that section of land. So they were torn down, which is unfortunate. It happened. So because of, you take that analogy, yes, these palaces, which were wonderful showcases, beautiful things back then, they, years afterwards, completely gone, completely.
Such a shame. So also, I don't know, I have no idea if you know anything about this either, so I can edit this out if you don't. Do you know anything just in terms of architecture about like the priest holes from the cat, like Nicholas Owen and all of that? I find that whole thing fascinating. Do you know anything about, like, did you study that at all?
Not really, but, you know, isn't it interesting? You have these, all these movies where all the kings or the queen, where Queen Elizabeth's guards coming, and then the priest has to like hide in this little hole and do mass in this tiny, tiny room, which is like the size of your closet, and hold mass there. But these were real situations. It was so dangerous because by the time of the 1560s, 70s, Catholicism was considered traitorous. You know, to harbor a priest or to convert someone or become a Catholic yourself, it was illegal.
I always think it's such a shame that Bloody Mary is considered bloody because of all the Protestants when Elizabeth did it as well. The same sort of thing. It's just she gets to write the history.
Yeah, I mean, she did her share of executions too.
Yeah. And it was spread out over a longer period of time and wasn't all, yeah. I find Nicholas Owen a fascinating character. I just wondered if you had studied him at all. So anyway, let's get into your new book then. Tell me about your new book, because I want to make sure we touch on that as well, because you have a book.
Well, it's called The Turbulent Crown, and it covers the queens from Elizabeth of York, Henry VIII's mother, down to her granddaughter, Elizabeth I. So Elizabeth to Elizabeth, like bookends. Yeah, I thought I would be interesting to write because, to my knowledge, there has not been a book covering the Tudor queens that way, from Elizabeth to Elizabeth, with the six wives thrown in. I mean, they were queen consorts, but, you know, they were queens nonetheless. So I thought it'd be great to write about that. And my interest is in the six wives, of course, and I thought it'd be fun to write.
Yeah, so who's your favorite queen then? Do you have a favorite?
Oh, Anne Boleyn.
Really?
You know, that everyone's favorite. She is so interesting. She is so interesting.
That's funny.
She's controversial. I mean, you know, there's so many things. A lot of people identify with her. I find this, you know, you read stuff on social media. She's a rock star.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, which is interesting because this is a new phenomenon, I think, that popped up in the 2000s. Because I remember before that, there was just not a lot of interest in her.
Mm-hmm.
Or the Tudors. I think that started with the movie Elizabeth with Cate Blanchett.
Okay.
That really brought a revival of interest in the Tudors, because before then it was these kind of masterpiece theater / BBC TV series, Six Wives of Henry VIII or Elizabeth R. They were great, but I think audiences, being a newer audience, needed something refreshed.
Yeah, and it was just kind of a perfect storm because you had the Philippa Gregory, the other Boleyn girl.
Oh yeah, the Tudors are very hot now. They're hot. And there was a period, I remember, where there was, you know, really no interest in them. There were very few books coming out. I mean, oh, there's an Anne Boleyn book. Well, you have to buy it because it's, you know, there hasn't been one for 5 years or 10 years. Now it's almost, I think, almost every 6 months, every month almost, whether they're published with a big publishing house or self-published or however, whatever means people get their books out there. But she's a hot property. You know, people find her, people love her.
Yeah, it's interesting because I just recently interviewed Alison Weir because she has the new book coming, the historical fiction on Anne, that's being released.
I know about that. Yeah.
Yeah. And she was talking about how people see Anne as an early feminist icon. And, you know, can you really put the label of a modern feminist on a 16th century woman? And yet there was that kind of, in Europe at the time, with the Christina Pizan and the different feminist, or you could almost call them feminist writers at the time, that were influencing the way women were seen. And it's just, she's certainly have changed things around. England has the religion it has because of her.
Yeah. And that's a relatively new phenomenon as well, from the, I suppose, around 2000s, because in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, she did not have that reputation. She actually had a bad one. She was like this, you know, the evil stepmother, the wicked queen. And that was the idea of her that was popularized back then. All the history books you read, oh, she's this, you know, not very nice lady. And I think that was because the scholarship on her was not as advanced as it has been recently. I mean, we know now that she's She was a patroness of religious reform. She was interested in the arts and a lot of things along those lines, where before there were no studies about that. She was simply this woman, you know, she's a hussy, she's an adventuress, and then she got what she deserved. I mean, that was the thinking in the earlier in the 20th century, let's say.
How much of that do you think has to do with the fact that historians were men then, and there's now women
that
historians?
That is true. That is true. Yeah, yeah. There are more women writing about her now. And one book which really shed new light on her life was this very famous book, Anne Boleyn, Her Life and Death by Eric Ives, which is you know, the Bible of Anne Boleynism. You know, everything you wanted to know and more, too, and more, sure. Which really established her as a player in politics, not just this, you know, the king's mistress and stuff like that. She was active in reform. She was active in this and that. And she was a, you know, a powerful woman.
I have to admit, it's just funny because now I've had two conversations about Anne Boleyn recently. And I've always, my eyes kind of glaze over when I think about Anne Boleyn, because it's like she's just so everywhere.
Isn't she everywhere? Yeah.
I've never was a huge fan. Not for any.
Right.
Just,
and you know, you have TV shows recently, like Ugly Betty.
Yeah.
You know that show?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Ugly Betty wore a Anne Boleyn bee necklace.
Oh, goodness. Yeah. It's just like,
and
this
pop culture, I don't know if it was meant to be an in-joke or not, because I don't think everybody in like middle America got it, but you know, the people who do know, oh my God, you know, she's wearing an Anne Boleyn necklace.
It's so funny.
So that's so Anne Boleyn has creeped into popular culture.
Yeah. My favorite's always been Anne of Cleves, because she seems clever, but.
Oh, she was. I think she deserves more credit than people give her. She was a smart lady, and you know, there's a lot of nonsense about, oh, she's so lucky when she was divorced because she led a life of leisure and she survived Henry VIII. But the truth is, she was miserable when she got divorced.
Yeah, she didn't want to get divorced.
Sorry?
She didn't want to get divorced, did she?
No, she didn't.
She kept seeing herself as the rightful queen of England, like after he...
She did.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when Catherine Howard was executed, she wanted to be wife number six, believe it or not. So she was, you know, wife number four, but she wanted to be wife number six. And she was actually miffed when Henry VIII married Catherine Parr, and she said something snarky. Oh, you know, I don't know why he married her. She's not as beautiful as I am. I think her perspective of Henry VIII was different from the other wives. I mean, she felt, you know, it was my destiny to become queen, and I was divorced, not because he didn't like me for whatever mysterious reasons, was because I had this pre-contract with somebody else. I mean, I believe her thinking was that she was divorced because of some legality about her being pre-contracted to someone else before. And I think she might have believed that, hence her thinking that, well, you know, that really doesn't matter. And once, you know, Catherine Howard is dead, let me become queen again because Henry VIII liked me, which actually was not true. And she was upset that she didn't become queen again. So I think that's a big misconception about her, because everyone goes on saying, oh, she's so lucky. She's the luckiest wife. She didn't end up with her head chopped off, you know?
Right. I wonder how much of that...
She was very willing to be married again.
I wonder how much of that has to do with the fact that both her and Catherine of Aragon were the foreign princesses who were groomed. Now, she wasn't necessarily groomed to be a queen like Catherine of Aragon was, but she was still groomed for a great marriage, and saw herself as, you know, somewhat above... She was this foreign princess kind of thing. I wonder if she saw herself in like a more dignified kind of way than these homegrown brides, and thinking.
Oh, definitely. I mean, there were arrangements for her marriage after Queen Jane Seymour died. So these great preparations. And I think she didn't understand why she was divorced. And again, her thinking was that it was over a silly pre-contract piece of legality, which is actually not legal, and I should become queen again. And there was an interesting quote by the imperial ambassador saying that when Queen Jane died, Henry VIII was not interested in looking for a foreign bride, because if the foreign bride ended up being like Anne Boleyn, like this, you know, this horrible woman, it would be hard to get rid of her. So therefore, we should marry, you know, locally. We cannot marry a foreign princess, because her family, powerful foreign family, would get pretty miffed and declare war on me.
Yeah, and he had to work out that divorce, didn't he? That took some strategizing on his part to not tick off the German states.
Yeah. So there was this whole thing about, oh, you know, she was She was not a virgin when she came to me. She smelled bad, and I can't stand her. But I think that was just a lot of excuses to make the marriage, to make the divorce actually possible. And I don't think Anne of Cleves ever heard all this, because this is all done, like, you know, behind closed doors. These horrible reasons that Henry VIII gave out about why the marriage cannot go on. So hence, she did not hear any of this. So she thought, oh, I'm getting divorced because of this contract thing with this person, Francis of Lorraine, when I was a child. Oh, it doesn't matter because, you know, I never married him. So I should be queen. I am queen. Catherine Howard's gone, so let me become queen again.
Something you don't expect women to say around Henry VIII.
No.
Many thanks to Roland for taking the time to talk with us today. Remember, go to the Englandcast website at englandcast.com, E-N-G-L-A-N-D-C-A-S-T, englandcast.com, to get the links to buy his book and to find out more about the paintings we covered. Remember, you can get in touch with me in a couple of different ways. The easiest is at the Facebook group, facebook.com/englandcast. And you can also tweet me at Tesco, at T-E-Y-S-K-O. You can also text the listener support line, which is 801-6-TESCO, 801-6-T-E-Y-S-K-O. Thanks so much for listening, and I will talk with you again soon. Bye-bye. Now we'll go right into the close.